This is 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. It's the Friday News Roundup. For the next hour or so, we'll park this week's maelstrom of news unfolding here in the nation's capital and catch up on some of the biggest stories from overseas. Our socially distant friends this week are Vivian Salama, correspondent with CNN. Vivian, good to have you here.
Amna, it's great to be here.
Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox. How are you doing, Jennifer?
Great to be here.
And David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. How are you, David?
Well, thank you.
So let's start with some news from the State Department. First, an announcement described by one of the world's leading international charities as, quote, an act of diplomatic vandalism. The outgoing Trump administration is set to designate Yemen's Houthi movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The decision was greeted with this response from the spokesperson for the Secretary General of the United Nations.
The short answer for us is that it risks making both the humanitarian and the political work of the UN in Yemen that much more complicated.
So that's going to come into effect on January 19th, the Trump administration's last full day in office. David, walk us through this. Who are the Houthis and what can you tell us about the timing behind this?
So Yemen, desperately poor country in Arabia, has been at war for 6 years. The Houthis were officially known as Ansar Allah. They ousted the internationally recognized government in 2014. And then a year later, you saw a coalition led by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates essentially trying to restore the original government with the help of Western countries, including the US, which have been giving them sales of weapons and training. And you have this overwhelming kind of air power of Western-backed air forces like the Saudis against this kind of rebel army that does control most of the population centers in the country. In the midst of that really vicious proxy war, the Houthis, who are backed by Iran, which explains the Saudi interest in this benighted conflict, you have 30 million people, of whom two-thirds would starve if they didn't receive international food aid. And the international food aid and fuel aid has become a pawn in that war. So you're seeing the Saudis imposing a fuel blockade. All aid has to go through a port controlled by the Houthis, but through a double system of UN checking and then a Saudi-controlled military system of checking. The Houthis, who are no angels, they steal a lot of the aid, they sell it. But what's really interesting is, although very few people are fans of the Houthis, they are brutal, they use children as hostages, they shell cities, they are not a nice bunch of people. No one thinks that this death declaration of them as terrorists at the very last minute of the Trump administration is really about trying to make things better on the ground. It's about politics, and it's about the fact that this is a proxy fight between the Sunni Arab giants like the Saudi Arabians and Iran, which is backing the Houthis. And America has thrown its weight in with its Saudi allies at the very last minute, and that seems certain to make it even more difficult to stave off a famine by getting the aid in.
Well, and the response from the international aid groups has been swift and strong. We mentioned the president of the International Rescue Committee called it an act of diplomatic vandalism. Oxfam called Pompeo's move, quote, counterproductive and dangerous. So, David, what stops Joe Biden and his administration from just immediately reversing the decision?
Well, these things are complicated to reverse legally. Once something is declared a foreign terrorist organization, there has to be a review process. It then becomes extremely political because, as with many of the last-minute moves being made by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and the rest of the national security bit of the Trump administration, there's a sense that they're trying to burn some bridges, whether it's picking fights, in this case, in the war in Yemen or elsewhere in the world. They're trying to box Joe Biden in. And Joe Biden is going to have to reverse so many pieces of foreign policy that he's going to have to spend political capital each time he does one of those. And so clearly, there is tremendous pressure on Joe Biden and the Americans, and there's probably bipartisan support in Congress for trying to get aid into Yemen to avoid that famine. But he's going to be accused of being soft on terrorism, he's going to be accused of being soft on Iran, and he's got so many of these sort of foreign policy forest fires to try and tackle as he comes into office that this is just yet another one. There's even the technical detail that this was done in such a hurry that some of the aid organizations and the UN are saying there's no legal protection for some of the aid organizations just trying to get aid in there, that they could fall foul of being seen to cooperate with a terrorist organization. Because remember, the Houthis, they're a rebel army, they're not nice people, but they control the ports that you need to get this aid in. So you have to work with them if you want to feed civilians in Yemen.
Meanwhile, Cuba is back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. On Monday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the move was intended to deny the Castro regime resources to, quote, oppress its people at home. It's also designed, he said, to, quote, counter its malign interference in Venezuela and the rest of the Western Hemisphere, end quote. Jennifer, what is going on here? Why add Cuba to this list now?
It's basically the same thing that David was just getting into, these kind of last-ditch moves to really box in the Biden administration. Cuba in particular has been something that, you know, the Trump administration has talked about for a long time, wanting to kind of reimpose these restrictions that the Obama administration had lifted pretty historically, right? So if you remember, back in May of 2015, is when Cuba was actually removed from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. And that came after just the previous month, President Obama had this historic meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro. And so, you know, the Obama administration had done kind of all of these really remarkable moves, lifting sanctions, allowing, you know, more travel, you know, cruise travel and things like that to Cuba. And the Trump administration has, you know, even on the campaign trail in 2016, was talking about wanting to kind of reverse those things. It did, but this was kind of the last ditch kind of move right before Biden comes in. And again, it's the similar kind of rationale that David was getting into, right? Yes, the Biden administration will be able to reverse this should it choose to, but it will have to spend political capital to do so. And given that, you know, the Biden administration is facing several other major crises right now, you know, the question is whether they will have the time, whether they will want to spend the political capital and the time and effort to do this, or if it will just languish for a while until they can get to it. And that's kind of one of the problems here.
Well, Cuba's foreign minister called out the Trump administration directly, saying the political opportunism of this action is recognized by anyone with an honest regard for the scourge of terrorism and its victims. Here's quickly how the news was received on the streets of Havana. Let me just translate here. This is a Cuban resident speaking to a local reporter, and she says Trump has a nightmare about Cuba. He will never lose the desire to attack Cuba, even if he's dead. Cuba bothers him, and that nightmare will never go away. She goes on to say he likes to think he's the owner of the world, but he isn't. Cuba's an obstacle for him, and it will be forever. Vivian, are there political risks for the new Biden administration to take steps on this quickly, to move things back to where they were and where they left off under President Obama?
There's always risks. And Cuba has been known for quite some time to support and the regimes, for example, in Venezuela and Nicaragua, which, you know, this administration has been particularly tough on. But other administrations are also sort of suspect of, because of the fact that they are repressive and clamping down on opposition and doing all these things that, you know, especially in the Western Hemisphere, no one really wants to see happening so close to the United States. And so, you know, for the Cuban regime, while they had tried to make some advancements to show their goodwill to the Obama administration, they weren't exactly, you know, in the clear as far as human rights goes and other issues that were of a concern. And so, you know, now when you go back, it's sort of green lighting any of their activities. And this is going to be the problem for the Biden administration on so many issues, you know, whether or not they reverse Trump policies and sort of indicate and signal to these regimes that it's okay for you to go back to what you were doing. It's not okay. And that's what they're going to have to try to find this balancing act. Same with Iran, same with so many different governments where it's like, okay, we're willing to work with you, we're willing to cooperate, but that doesn't mean that you can go back and crack down on your opposition and restrict the press and do all these things. And so that's going to be a really delicate balancing act for the Biden administration moving forward.
Vivian, meanwhile, we should mention you broke a big story about President-elect Biden eyeing cuts to America's $1.2 trillion nuclear modernization program. What else can you tell about that?
Well, I'm going to think about it. 16 days after now President-elect Joe Biden takes office, a very critical nuclear pact with Russia is set to expire. And that was something that was basically a framework for trying to regulate any nuclear development or nuclear activity by the United States and Russia. So they hit the ground running. Actually, they hit the ground sprinting, I should say, in terms of trying to determine what their nuclear policy will be with sort of the big fish, if you will, Russia, trying to
find this, you know, an extension perhaps, and that's what's expected, is that they were going to look to extend this very imperfect nuclear agreement. But beyond that, now the Biden administration is looking to the broader U.S. nuclear policy, and especially on the heels of the Trump administration, which escalated the U.S. nuclear proliferation and activities and modernization. In fact, he plans to revisit what is a $1 trillion nuclear modernization program to see whether or not basically it warrants the expenditure. And a lot of people out there hear this and they think, oh my God, like, it's a dangerous world. Why would he cut back on nuclear development and nuclear modernization? But their thinking is that they want to really focus more on arms control, not on building weapons. And the Trump administration was the opposite. They believed in both, let's say, to be fair to them. They did want to talk about arms control and did try to pursue some agreements, but they also canceled agreements with Russia and others. They wanted to wait on this nuclear pact to get China involved. And so the Biden administration is going to basically take a different track there.
It's a big story. It was broken first by one of our guests. That's Vivian Salama from CNN. We're also talking to Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox, and David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. This is the Friday News Roundup. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, and this is 1A. It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. Our guests this week are Vivian Salama from CNN, Jennifer Williams from Vox, and staying up late for us to join us from Beijing is David Rennie. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. So during his 4 years in power, President Trump has taken a hard line on China. And in his final weeks, he's working to lock in that stance. On Saturday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. will lift rules against interactions between American and Taiwanese diplomats. David, that move really angered China. Tell us why.
It was interesting. It made them angry because China takes the view that Taiwan is no more than a province of China, that it is part of China, even though, in fact, it's never been ruled by the communist government in Beijing. It's the last seat of the previous Chinese regime that fled the mainland and ended up in exile in Taiwan in 1949. The Americans are committed to sell defensive weapons to Taiwan. They don't have a treaty promise to defend Taiwan, but there is a very strong political agreement that if the Chinese ever tried to invade Taiwan and take it by force, the Americans would be there. And part of the delicate game of pretending that Taiwan isn't completely an independent country is that there isn't an American embassy there, and that until very recently, people like cabinet secretaries or very senior officials did not go there. You had these kind of lower level ties. Under the Trump administration, some China hawks around President Trump have taken advantage of Mr. Trump's desire to poke the Chinese in the eye. And although President Trump himself doesn't frankly care at all about Taiwan or the fact that it's a democracy or an American ally, and he's been very dismissive of it in private, he's allowed the hawks to punch and to try and increase ties. And the most recent dramatic move, one of these last-minute moves designed to box in President Biden's administration and also to send signals, I think, if you're Mike Pompeo, has presidential ambitions, that he is a kind of true blue conservative, what they've been doing is that they've said that they'll now be essentially no limits to the meetings that Americans can make. He tried to send the UN ambassador, the United States UN ambassador Kelly Craft, to Taiwan at the last minute. That would be very, very symbolic, because Taiwan leaving the UN and being replaced by China was one of the great acts of the kind of rapprochement with China under the sort of the Nixon-Carter establishment of diplomatic relations with China. And so the UN is a very, very sensitive point. What's interesting is that at the very last minute, almost as she was in the air, the UN ambassador was called back, because what we're seeing is that the State Department has decided not to try and send any more teams out because the inauguration is so close. And so Taiwan's been left a bit dangling. And there are people who are on Taiwan's side who think that actually, frankly, the Trump administration has hung them out to dry by promising more American support than actually America is really willing to give them.
Well, Jennifer, tensions between the U.S. and China were already high. David just laid out how the China hawks have really been pushing forward their agenda. How much does a move like this further escalate tensions?
I mean, it certainly doesn't help ease tensions. This contact guidance, which is basically what David was describing, these kind of guidelines that were used to help officials and diplomats navigate these interactions, you know, were basically intended to make sure that U.S. officials didn't accidentally cause this international incident by, you know, meeting with a Taiwanese official in the wrong place or in an official capacity. This is definitely important that, you know, Chinese government kind of even responded, pointing out, you know, going back to the December 1978 Carter communique, you know, talking about the kind of laying out the idea of one China policy and U.S., treating Taiwan as if, you know, very delicately, as if China is still, the only, you know, Beijing is still in control. There's a lot going on with China beyond just Taiwan, right? And there always will be. You have, you know, the trade war that President Trump started with China. They came to this kind of sort of first stage agreement, and then COVID hit. And so it's not really entirely clear where that trade agreement is left right now. So Biden is going to have to come in, and he's going to have to deal with, you know, escalated tensions in Taiwan, but also the issue of, you know, the COVID outbreak and China's role in that. They're going to have to deal with the trade issues. All of this stuff, there's also a diplomatic spat kind of ongoing between Beijing and Australia. So there's all this stuff that the U.S. needs to work with China on, but also press China on when it comes to things like Hong Kong and its treatment of the Uyghurs. It's really difficult, you know, to kind of pick out one piece like Taiwan without, you know, addressing kind of a lot of the broader issues, right? You can never really deal with China on just one specific issue when there are so many other moving parts, even when it comes to things like North Korea. So it's a huge portfolio of issues that the incoming administration is going to have to deal with. And we've seen, you know, Joe Biden take a much more hawkish kind of position. Some, you know, thought it was just because on the campaign trail to kind of challenge Trump. But also, I think, you know, there's a realization of a need to push China.
Well, let's stay on the topic of China for a second, because now, as we reported earlier, there's an international team of researchers from the World Health Organization who arrived just yesterday. They are in Wuhan to investigate the origins of the pandemic. David, tell us what we need to know about the investigation. What exactly are they looking for at this point in the pandemic?
I think listeners can be forgiven for thinking, why on earth is this investigation turning up a year after the pandemic began in Wuhan? And the answer is politics. The answer is that China is spreading a story, which it is spreading with incredible force and assertiveness, that it is grotesque to say that China is to blame for COVID, that it may not have even begun in Wuhan, that maybe it was first spotted in Wuhan because Chinese scientists are unusually diligent. But we have seen very senior Chinese officials just kind of throwing out random theories about where this virus may have begun, whether it was India or Italy or the UK or the American military maybe brought it in, or maybe it began in several places simultaneously, which was the line from the Chinese foreign minister over the new year. Anything rather than admit that actually at the beginning of this, for a month, maybe 2 months, there was a cover-up by communist officials who didn't want to admit that they had a new virus on their hands in Wuhan. So now you have this team from the World Health Organization. It was supposed to be 15, it's now only 13, because two of their members were stopped in Singapore because they had antibodies in their blood when they were tested. They're not even on the ground, they're in quarantine now for two more weeks. There are no promises on the Chinese side that they will get to talk to the Chinese doctors, some of whom certainly know about that cover-up because they were there trying to get information out and were punished for getting it out. So really, I'm afraid this investigation is anything but the real independent scientific probe into where this deadly disease began and how to prevent another one taking place. It is an entirely political, very controlled exercise, grudgingly allowed onto the ground in a very limited way by a Chinese government determined to say that COVID is actually a triumph for the Chinese Communist Party because they've controlled the virus now within China's closed borders.
Well, the investigation begins as China's experiencing a spike in coronavirus cases. The country recently reported its first coronavirus death in 6 months. That's put more than 22 million people under lockdown. David, I want to stay with you here because the flare-up in those cases, it's still relatively low compared to the U.S. How bad is it? What do we know?
Look, it's incredibly low in numbers terms. I mean, this is the remarkable thing. I've not left China for more than a year now. I've been here throughout the entire pandemic. It's very hard for outsiders to understand just how different China's strategy is. China is determined not just to kind of bend the curve to try and achieve, you know, below the curve. China wants no cases. So we're in a country of 1.4 billion people. The borders are basically completely locked against the outside world at the moment. And they are locking whole cities down for a dozen cases. There's a city not very far from me with 11 million people in it who are not allowed outside their homes. There are police checkpoints blocking every road in and out of that city, Shijiazhuang. And they have a total of about 400 cases. Now, an American city with 400 cases would be celebrating, because you're seeing American cities with thousands, tens of thousands of cases every day. So China is trying something incredibly ambitious, which is to completely suppress this virus. But the cost of that is that every time they get a tiny outbreak, they are locking whole cities down. So we have more than 23 million people currently on lockdown, and Chinese New Year, which is their equivalent of Thanksgiving and Christmas, all rolled into one, is coming up in about a month, just under a month. And basically hundreds of millions of Chinese are not going to be allowed to go home and see their families. They're going to cancel Chinese New Year, more or less, for an awful lot of people. It's incredibly harsh, but that's their strategy. And it's supported by a lot of Chinese people who are very frightened of this virus. But it's so different from what's being done in the States.
Jennifer, we have to ask, too, briefly, if we can, because it's been asked before, can we trust China's reporting on the coronavirus cases and death numbers?
That's a really great question. And, you know, I'm sure David has quite a perspective on that as well. But, you know, that's something that I've been kind of talking to reporters about, you know, even in my own work. You know, just how much do we know? Just how much, you know, as David was saying, early in the pandemic, you know, there were lots of, you know, cover-ups going on from the Chinese government. So the question is, well, you know, how trustworthy are they now going forward with these cases? But I think, you know, the point that David made is that they are kind of openly saying, you know, if there are X number of cases, you know, even if there are a few cases, we're locking down. So I think the fact that they are taking these really dramatic and drastic mitigation measures, you know, that does lend itself to the, you know, the idea that they are very well controlling the virus. You know, it's also having, as David mentioned, you know, these lockdowns, it has a huge economic impact, as we've seen all across the world. We've seen here in the U.S. with, you know, job losses and just kind of wrecking entire sectors of the economy. So it's extremely difficult. So, you know, I would think that if China is taking these steps, it's not doing it just kind of, you know, wantonly, but is actually trying to crack down. But again, you know, what we actually know in terms of, you know, additional kind of spread and things like that, it is really hard to kind of verify.
It's the Friday News Roundup. My guests this week are Vivian Salama from CNN, Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox, and David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. One of Russia's most prominent opposition leaders says he's headed back to Moscow after what was likely a failed assassination attempt. Russian agents allegedly poisoned Alexei Navalny back in August. He spent almost half a year recuperating in Germany. Vivian, Navalny has always been adamant that he would go back. Here, take a quick listen to what he had to say late last year in an interview with 60 Minutes.
Everyone asking me this question, are you afraid? Are you going to come back to Russia? And my job is to not be afraid and go back to Russia. I can see that Kremlin right now, they do everything to prevent me being back to Moscow, but it's never going to happen.
So it may never happen, but they're certainly going to try. Russia's prison service said in a statement yesterday they've been ordered to detain Navalny as soon as he enters the country. Vivian, the question has to be asked, why is he going back?
It's symbolic. I mean, and I don't think he's ever been under any misconception that he risked immediate arrest the second that he steps foot back in Russia. But he has said all along that he intends to go back. And, you know, this is sort of what he has come to stand for, is this defiance to Moscow, to the Kremlin, the seat of government in Russia. And he's continued to sort of show that. He's also trying to show strength because of the fact that he was targeted, we know, by a nerve agent. You know, CNN and Bellingcat have done extensive studies that showed that that Russia's Federal Security Service had formed an elite team specializing in nerve agents to go after Navalny for years. And his phone and travel records suggested the same thing, that they were following him through at least 17 cities. So he's not under any misconception about what is happening here. And, you know, trying to even show defiance to other opposition leaders, you know, kind of a newer generation, that if you stand up to the government, this is the way to kind of break them down. And because of the fact that there's been so much international support for Navalny and his plight and what happened to him, you know, it also kind of raises the stakes and raises pressure against President Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. And it's also important to notice, though, that, you know, one government that hasn't been, or one president that has not been outspoken with regard to Navalny's plight is President Trump. The administration has spoken out against what happened to Navalny and what has happened, you know, just any kind of systemic oppression of opposition figures in Russia. But President Trump himself has not called out Russia, which is in keeping with sort of his pattern. And so, you know, that, in a lot of ways, for Vladimir Putin, is sort of carte blanche in terms of, okay, well, if I'm not going to get, you know, smacked on the hand for this, I can continue doing that. Now we have a new president coming in 5 days, and it remains to be seen how Biden will kind of approach the relationship with Moscow. We know that the Obama administration had strained ties with Moscow, obviously, and was really looking to crack down. It's likely that the Biden administration will be much more outspoken against any kind of oppression that Vladimir Putin and his government do against any opposition or anyone, for that matter, the press or whatever. And so that's going to be really what is interesting. The timing of Navalny's return is what is key here, because of the fact that you're going to have a new U.S. president, and you've already seen this outgoing administration cranking up the pressure with sanctions and other things. And so it's likely that that will continue. Whether or not that sways Vladimir Putin, that remains to be seen.
Well, Navalny is one of the most prominent opposition leaders there. He has, as you said, increased the pressure on Putin. We don't yet know what the incoming Biden administration will want to do, but we know they do want to increase the pressure a bit. So does Navalny's return help them in a sense?
I mean, it certainly does, and especially if, as has been threatened, they arrest him when he lands. I'm sure that that's going to be an issue that comes up. And for our listeners who were tuning in earlier, I was talking about nuclear talks that are coming up in 16 days' time once Biden takes office. President Putin and Biden have both expressed an interest in extending the nuclear accord. But there's no doubt that the Biden administration will dangle conditions in front of them to appease that interest. And so that's going to be something that's going to be very interesting, to see whether they play the nuclear talks against some of these issues, including Navalny's detention, to see if that they can compel some compliance from the Russian government.
David, I'd love to get your take briefly. If Navalny is detained, what then? What do we see happen?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's clearly terrifying for him. He's running these incredible risks. But this is the trap for any opposition leader fighting an autocracy as brutal and powerful as Vladimir Putin's, which is that if you stay in exile, you lose your relevance very quickly. So I think there is this kind of brutal calculation for someone like Navalny, that he has power when he is there on the ground, despite the clear risks that they just tried to kill him and he's going to be potentially put in prison for this frankly, very politicized accusation that he's broken a probation agreement back to a trial in 2014 that could see him put in prison for 3.5 years. But he knows that when he's on the ground, issuing these videos, being defiant, not showing fear of Vladimir Putin, that undermines the very basis of Vladimir Putin's rule, which is that he is all powerful and must be feared. And so you can see that these two figures, one with all the power in the world, Vladimir Putin, and one just with his own courage, they are weirdly evenly matched if he goes back and shows he's not afraid.
This is 1A. If you're keeping count or having trouble keeping count, it is Friday. And that means this is the Friday News Roundup. My guests this week are Vivian Salama from CNN, Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox, and David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. We're going to hear more from you and from our guests in just a moment. This is 1A. Let's get back now to the Friday News Roundup. My guests this week are Vivian Salama from CNN, Jennifer Williams, Senior Foreign Editor at Vox, and David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. In Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has been in power for 35 years, but that could change this week. After Thursday's election, popular singer-turned-opposition leader Bobi Wine has claimed victory against the country's longtime leader, though results are still being tallied.
I am very confident that we defeated the dictator by far. I call upon all Ugandans to reject the blackmail. We have certainly won this election, and we've won it by far. General Museveni and his small clique of oppressors are trying yet again to impose themselves on the people of Uganda. The people of Uganda will and must reject the blatant usurpation of their will and their voice. I want to ask all Ugandans to remain firm and confident that through this election, we have spoken and we have spoken clearly.
On Friday morning, Bobi Wine tweeted, quote, "We are under siege. The military has jumped over the fence and has now taken control of our home." Jen, CNN is also reporting journalists who were going to his residence for a press conference were turned back by security forces. What do we know about what's going on here?
Not much, honestly. I actually, during the commercial break or the quick break, refreshed his Twitter just to make sure to see if he had tweeted anything. And he hasn't since the kind of pair of tweets that he put out after that first one that you read. He tweeted shortly after, quote, "None of these military intruders is talking to us. We are in serious trouble. We are under siege." And that was the last thing that he tweeted about 3 hours ago. So this is a situation that is still unfolding. You know, if you remember, Bobi Wine has been arrested several times while he was campaigning. He was never charged. His supporters were also arrested. At one point when he was arrested, thousands of his supporters took to the streets. There ended up being these really dramatic armed clashes. There were tons of arrests there. There were at least 50 people were killed. At one point in late November, Bobi Wine actually had to briefly suspend his campaign because members of his campaign and his car were injured. His car was shot at. So definitely the security forces under control of Museveni have tried really hard to get rid of Bobi Wine and to force him to, you know, suspend his campaign and stop campaigning. And it's very worrisome, you know, because there's limited access right now, given that journalists are not being able to get close. It's unclear what's actually happening. But given the kind of pattern that we've seen throughout the campaign of the government security forces really trying to you know, stop him at every turn, it's definitely really concerning.
Vivian, this week there was also an internet blackout, and Bobi Wine and other of Museveni's opponents have said that there was widespread fraud and there was violence throughout the campaign, as Jen was just mentioning in some anecdotes as well. Were there international observers? Do we know more about how the election unfolded? Was it peaceful? Was it free? Was it fair?
That information is still coming out. Obviously, Bobi Wine is claiming that there has been some widespread fraud in the election, and he's raising concern about it. Although he still thinks that he's very confident to come out. And any attempts by international observers to monitor the election, of course, there have been efforts to do that. But the government under Museveni has been trying its best to avoid that because of this fact that, you know, for the first time in more than three decades, he is facing a real threat to his reign in Uganda. And I want to say I spent about a month in Uganda tracing Museveni's legacy a couple of years ago, and just to see sort of how his star has faded. Museveni came in basically following the worst of the decades of bloodshed that happened in Uganda under the notorious dictator Idi Amin. And he was seen as the savior who brought peace and stability to the country. But over the years, he's kind of used that star power to impose gradually more and more autocratic practices, clamping down on opposition, clamping down on the press. You know, he's manipulated rebel groups within the country, especially due to proxy wars with neighboring DRC and South Sudan, and has kind of used that to his benefit to sort of protect his own border. Uganda has some oil wealth, and he even calls that oil my oil, quote unquote, and has really monopolized that to benefit his seat of power and his reign. And so over these recent years, especially, even infighting within his party, I mean, there was a really big episode a couple of years ago with regard to an anti-homosexuality bill in Uganda that made international news, and it caused huge infighting within his party because Museveni ultimately believed that that was sort of an evil presence in the country, homosexuals, and he was locking them up and abusing them and torturing them. He's also used his power to clamp down on security, calling the opposition terrorists, because you've had episodes of attacks in Uganda, but also in neighboring countries in Eastern Africa. And so he's kind of used that to say that he's cracking down on terrorism, and he has actually leveraged that to get international support, including U.S. support for his efforts, where he says we're fighting terrorism, but really the opposition tends to suffer. And so just to make our listeners understand, this has been sort of a gradual decline with Museveni, who was once this beloved figure who brought peace to the country, and now, has the country in a chokehold, even as we speak with this election that very truly may have unseated him, but it remains to be seen whether those results will actually be truthful and we'll know the real results, or if fraudulent practices, as the opposition is claiming, really takes the lead and keeps him in power.
Well, David, Vivian brings us very neatly to this moment in time, because when you look at Uganda today, according to the New York Times, more than 75% of the population is under the age of 30. Most of the concerns there are really about jobs and the economy. That's been a central part of Bobi Wine's campaign. Does he actually have a chance of unseating Museveni?
You're right. It's like many African countries, incredibly young. It's the median age is 16. Bobi Wine is a very charismatic figure. He's a former raga star. He grew up in the slums. His nickname is the Ghetto President. He has a lot of the things that you would need. He's 38 years old, so he's literally half the age of President Museveni. And a lot of President Museveni's kind of arguments about his glorious role as a kind of rebel leader, they mean nothing to people who are in their kind of teens or early 20s. They don't remember the first decades of Museveni's rule. So he should be poised to take advantage, as you say, of this sense of economic stagnation, increasing lack of freedom. You mentioned the fact that the internet has been down now for three, four days. Facebook was banned. You know, all the kind of the openings and the opportunities that you need to keep a very, very young country from boiling over are being clamped down by this old autocrat. And Bobi Wine is this very charismatic figure who came from the slums, who came from this kind of pop star background. But it has to be said that if you look at the kind of the analysis from diplomats and observers on the ground, they don't really expect Museveni to give up power this easily. And I think that's why we're all now watching these signs of what looks like the latest sort of stranglehold getting even tighter around Bobi Wine in his large house in Kampala.
You're listening to the Friday News Roundup. My guests this week are Vivian Salama from CNN, Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox, and David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Let's finally turn now to the global reaction to some of the turmoil that's been playing out right here in the United States this week. On Wednesday, the U.S. House of Representatives impeached President Trump for a second time. David, you're in Beijing. How is this being reported where you are?
Glee. It comes on the heels of the Chinese state media has basically been spending the last few months in absolute heaven. They've been saying, look at America. They can't cope with COVID. They're doing a terrible job of coping with this virus, which shows that democracies are no good at looking after the people. The Communist Party is superior. They're also telling this incredibly cynical message about everything from the impeachment, which is sort of a political kind of stitch up by the elites who show that democracy doesn't really exist, the attack on the Capitol, which is being compared to the protests we saw in Hong Kong last year. So when America gets involved, it brings violence and chaos. How much worse it is to have democracy, how much safer, more stable to have one party that's looking after you, that really cares about the people. Even the fact that President Trump has been kicked off Twitter is being played up with glee by the incredibly strictly censored state media here as proof that there's no such thing as free speech. It's just a wicked lie. Don't believe that the West is any better. They're just like us. And I'm afraid If you look at the admittedly very censored Chinese social media, a huge number of ordinary Chinese are basically buying into this idea that America, above all, that all Western democracies are broken and that there's nothing to envy them.
We should also mention some global leaders have shared concerns about the way that Twitter and Facebook have policed President Trump. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called Twitter's decision to permanently suspend the president's account a violation of the, quote, fundamental right to free speech. And Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny tweeted, quote, I think that the ban of Donald Trump on Twitter is an unacceptable act of censorship. Jen, help us break down some of the different responses here and what it really tells us about where we might be headed on the issues around free speech.
Sure. Well, what's really interesting is that when you hear just kind of the first part of what Merkel and some other European leaders, including in France and elsewhere, had to say, it sounds that, you know, like they are saying that, you know, free speech should be respected at all costs. When you actually drill down into what they were saying is they were saying that that corporations, that companies like Twitter, like Facebook, shouldn't be the ones controlling free speech, but rather that it should be the government. So it's a bit of a more of a complex kind of picture when you actually look at what they're trying to say. And that's because Germany and others have long kind of argued that the control of, you know, what is acceptable speech and what isn't should not be left to these really powerful corporations, but that it's up to the government to, you know, provide the kind of framework and regulations. You know, Europe has been trying really hard to add regulations into, you know, internet companies, Google, and, you know, social media companies. And so this is actually kind of more in line with that effort. So, you know, I don't think that anyone, you know, who I guess are hardcore free speech advocates would be saying, I think the government should be, you know, restricting our speech. But that's actually kind of what they're saying. You know, remember in Germany, you know, lots of things, not just hate speech, but even, you know, symbols related to, you know, kind of Nazi past are all banned. And so, you know, there's a little bit of a different perspective when it comes to who should be regulating this speech. And I think that's kind of a fascinating difference because in the United States, obviously, you know, yes, there is this conversation that, companies shouldn't have, you know, this power. But it's also not saying that, you know, there are arguments that the government should be doing better to regulate, but it's the opposite. It's that the government should be doing more to make sure that Twitter can't shut down this kind of speech rather than saying the government needs to have more control over banning certain types of speech. So it's much of a kind of a different perspective.
In other news this week on Sunday, former Republican governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, condemned last week's deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol. On YouTube, he posted a video comparing the insurrection to Kristallnacht, the anti-Semitic riot in Germany that preceded the Holocaust.
Now, I grew up in Austria. I'm very aware of Kristallnacht, or the night of broken glass. It was a night of rampage against the Jews carried out in 1938 by the Nazi equivalent of the Proud Boys. Wednesday was the day of broken glass right here in the United States. The broken glass was in the windows of the United States Capitol. But the mob did not just shatter the windows of the Capitol, they shattered the ideals we took for granted.
Vivian, within hours, that video drew nearly 10 million views on Twitter. How was that comparison to Kristallnacht received?
Mixed. Some historians, and I'm certainly not an expert in what happened the night of Kristallnacht, but reading what historians have said, some of them felt it was somewhat of a unequal comparison and that maybe he went a little bit too far with it. Obviously, very emotional comparison for Arnold Schwarzenegger, but perhaps a little bit off in terms of the historical reference. But then there were others who believed that it is a very accurate image of this group of people marching through the streets, inciting hatred, denouncing the courts, denouncing rule of law, denouncing the legislature, and just doing what they want to do. A lot of images, imagery of civil war that have kind of perpetrated, and a lot of historians also pointing to that image of U.S. civil war and marching through the streets with candlesticks and, torches and things like that. A lot of historic references to the images that happened last week. And even, you know, I was a foreign correspondent for 13 years in several different countries, and I was getting flooded by messages From around the world, from friends just saying, you know, how can this even happen in the United States, in a place where diversity is such a major component of who the United States is and stands for, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. And all of a sudden you have these hate groups going through the streets, tearing down the Capitol and marching right in. It was just such a startling image to the world, because it actually just, for so many people, I know, certainly in the Middle East, friends that I spoke to said, if this can happen in the Middle East, if this can happen in the United States, in Washington, D.C., it can happen anywhere. And it was something that they felt, you know, it just, the equilibrium of the entire world was basically knocked down because of this. And so, a lot of emotions. Arnold Schwarzenegger, one of them, but people around the world also just relating it to horrible incidents of hatred and violence in their parts of the world, too. And it really just unsettled so many people.
David, briefly before we go, we should mention that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, spoke to the Voice of America, and he said the organization's broadcasts have become less about telling the truth and too often about demeaning America. David, briefly, how do you think the world is viewing and will view this administration's foreign policy legacy? How does that square with what we've heard from inside the administration itself?
Look, it's tragic. I was based in America for 9 years in Washington, and I mean, I used to go on Voice of America when it was incredibly proud of its editorial independence. That was a kind of Cold War relic, that you could trust what the Americans were saying because the government didn't tell them what to do. America was about the truth and facts and good journalism. And like so many things about foreign policy in America under the Trump administration, is being grotesquely politicized. I'm afraid that friends of America are heartbroken and worried right now, mm-hmm. and enemies of America, where I'm sitting here in China, are gleeful at this display to them of American failure.
That is David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist, one of our guests this week, along with Vivian Salama from CNN and Jennifer Williams, Senior Foreign Editor at Vox. Thank you to you all. 1A Senior Producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer, and Barb Anguiano produces this podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. Jen will be back on Monday, and I'll be back in a few weeks. Please have a great weekend. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. This is 1A.